Well, good afternoon. I guess it's been a couple weeks here. We've all been traveling for Thanksgiving, or at least staying home to eat with our family and friends. I hope everything went well for the holiday. We were down in Oregon with my mom. While we were there, what you do when you visit my mom is you watch TV. That's how the program is. You watch TV. And you watch loud TV, if you understand how that works. So I kind of just set myself, and I remember as a kid, that's what we did. Even when I was a kid, we watched TV. I laid there on the floor, and it was Lawrence Welk, and it was something else. And so that's just kind of, you know, I don't really watch TV. So it's strange for me to go into a culture where all of a sudden that's what everybody will now be doing. So anyway, we watched the movie, and I know that many of you will have seen it over the years. Jimmy Stewart, just, you can guess it, you know. It's a Wonderful Life. You know, I hated that movie all my life. Not because I've seen it so many times, but just because of the way I'm personally wired and trying to unwire. But every time Jimmy Stewart plans something, it gets shot full of holes. And so I've had this impression of this movie that basically, if you want it, you can't have it. That's the way I described the movie. If you want it, you can't have it, because you got to do the right thing. And the reason that's always been kind of a thorn in my flesh is because kind of that's how I think too. I don't think in terms of if you want it, you can't have it so much, but I'm very much driven in terms of wanting to try to do the right thing. And part of that reason is the way I grew up and all the problems I created for family members and society. And as God called me into the church, I guess in some ways in my mind I wanted to pay some of that back. Not that you can pay it back, but in my mind I did. And so it's been very important to me when choices were presented to me that I could say, all right, this is fun, but this is important. And I always hoped that the things that were fun would get kind of built into the program. But from time to time, I saw in my life things would happen where everything would just kind of change almost instantly. And I think all of us probably have expressed those or experienced those things as well. I remember going through college thinking, all right, I'm going to learn all the sports I can learn in this life, and then I'm going to live a life of adventure. That's what I wanted to do. Honestly wanted to do that. And I've mentioned over time, but, you know, I parachuted in the Army and took flying lessons at Big Sandy, and we took scuba lessons, and we skied, and we hiked and packed, and we did everything we could get our hands on. We sailed boats. We friends of mine and I basically tried to train and experience everything we could. And one day we wanted to work that into a way of life. Of course, everybody would like that, would they not? But again, we had a specific plan. So I went out to Texas, and I hired on to a job that would start in 2 weeks. And I went back to California to visit with some friends, and my car broke down, and I hung around, and I just never left. While I was down there, Mr. LaRavia offered me a job, and I came to that choice. And this is why the movie used to kind of rankle me a little bit, because I came to that choice. I said, all right, what do I want? Well, I want to live a life of adventure. And then I said, but what's important? What's important is to do the work. And so I was at that juncture, and I thought, well, Mr. LaRavia wants me to work as his aide and assistant. That's a good job. I'll work for him, and we'll do the work. And so I signed off of what I had planned to do literally just within a day or two's time of what I had been literally preparing over a period of years. And I prepared in my mind then to do the work. I mean, I wanted to do that regardless, but as my whole focus, that's not where I had been. Went to work for Mr. LaRavia. The very next day, the receivership was established, set for those of you who were there on the church in Pasadena. And his job changed the very next day, as basically he took over the reins of all of the assets of the church. And all of a sudden, for an aide or a personal assistant, he needed someone else. I had been working for him 2 days. and my job had evaporated, and now I was a staff aide over time, and it worked out where he had brought in someone else, at that time a minister, to assist him in that job. I thought back on that. I said, if anybody would have told me in advance of what I would end up doing, I would have never done it. I would have said, no, I won't do that. I want to, as they said, you know, I want to live a life of danger. I want to, well, be an airborne ranger. Not really. Kelly does. But it was kind of that mentality in my mind. But, you know, I stayed. And I said, isn't that amazing? I set my life up, and then I said, okay, I will forego that. And I will take this, and the minute I went there, it disappeared. And I ended up working at the savings and loan. If you can imagine, It's a Wonderful Life, Jimmy Stewart. And so when I'd see that movie on TV, it would rankle me a bit, because I said, you know, it is important. Let's do the right thing, but why should all those other things evaporate at the same time? So I always thought, that poor guy, why didn't he just go build the building and take the trip and spend the money one time? Well, it's interesting. Near the end of the movie, he's going to jump in the river. He's had it. He's given up. Somebody else jumps in first, and he had to save them. He did the right thing. He couldn't even jump off the bridge without having to do the right thing first. As we get older, our life focus changes a bit. So I'm watching this movie, and I'm telling Megan, you know, I said, oh, I hate this movie, you know. You know, I try to ruin it for everybody else, right? Because they're going to sit there and watch this thing. And I said, oh, this drives me crazy, you know. But I started watching it, and all of a sudden, you know, I realized it wasn't driving me quite as crazy as it used to. And then at the end, I'm actually sitting there in my chair quietly with my head a little bit, and tears are running down my face, you know. I'm watching this movie, you know. I'm going, look at this guy. He did all this good, and he stood up against all this evil, and the whole course of this community changed. And I'm watching him going, you know, this is a pretty good movie. Now, you know, I didn't tell that to my family because I didn't want to ruin my image, you know, because I've complained about this movie so many times. But I honestly finished it for the first time in my life. And I could say, you know, that's a pretty good movie. And I thought, that's interesting. Something changed. When we get older, we look at life differently, do we not? Now, you wouldn't know that till you get there. But you look at life differently. It's not as much about, you know, all your hopes and dreams as it is when we're young. Because when we're young, we're very idealistic, and there's so many things we're going to accomplish and take to task, and we're going to win, and we're going to pursue, and we're going to, you know, do all of these tasks. And you go through life and you sacrifice a little bit for a child, for a relationship, for your work, for a community, for a church, for your neighbor. You sacrifice a few things, and you make that decision. You say, I'm going to do the right thing. Not necessarily the most exciting thing, the right thing. And it changes you. And when you get older, life is more about family. You know, to hear a grandparent talk about a grandchild, I'm always amazed. I don't have a grandchild. And I wonder if I can ever get there. Where that feeling and that emotion, I listen to that and I hear that. And it's consistent. I figured, well, I'm about like everybody else, and everybody else is about like me. I suppose it will happen, just like watching that movie. You know, when you're 53, finally the movie is okay. You know, your life focus changes. It is important for us to focus on doing the right thing, but we need to be there sometimes to understand it more fully. Greg was talking in the announcements about Louise. There at home, and Kitty helping her. You know, there's Ida Wright that's there at home, and Ida will call me on occasion and just say hi, and, you know, I haven't been there. I haven't been over to the house. And I feel like, you know, I need to be there more often, but it's not just that. There's Don Robinson. There's Eileen Thornton down in Kennewick. You know, Callie's home. Now, Mert's not here. I'm assuming she's with Callie. Mert walked out of Callie's trailer house there this week, and within 2 hours, Callie was not able to respond to the door for the person that was supposed to come and check on her. Within 2 hours. And so Mert was spending time trying to figure out there and set up and help out with Callie. But, you know, we have people who genuinely need the companionship and the friendship and the support of the congregation in terms of a visit. You know, Frank mentioned to me that he'd gone by to see Dawn, and I was so grateful because in the back of my mind I'm saying, you know, I need to go by and see Dawn again. I haven't been there. When you're older and you've spent your life processing these things, trying to do what's right, sacrificing for someone else, and you get to that point in time where importance is friends, importance is family, importance is no longer the house or the acquisition or the adventure or the opportunity of these great, you know, events. It's different. And I would just ask you all to think about those individuals in our congregation who are not able to be out. There's Darlene. I mean, Darlene's not generally even up to a visit, is she, Carl, as a whole? But we pray for her. And once in a while, she comes up and makes it in here to church. And it's like Eileen down in Kennewick. I don't know how Eileen gets to church. I mean, if you could see her, those of you men and ladies that travel down, I mean, she just barely gets around and functions at all. And yet she's incredible. And every time I see her, I'll ask, I said, thank you for coming. Thank you for making that effort. It's an incredible example. She just wants to be there, and she fights her way on in. It's a sacrifice. She's not doing it because it's fun. It's important. In our character, brethren, we need to really understand that the blessings in this life are great, and they're things that we easily indeed do desire, but we need to make sure that we do the right thing. Look at Psalm 15. The whole psalm hill, in terms of our character and the types of decisions we make. It says, Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell on your holy hill? He who walks uprightly and works righteousness. See, it's works righteousness. It's not a concept, it's an action. It's an action. Speaks the truth in his heart. Who does not backbite with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor does he take up a reproach against his friend, in whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change, keeps his word no matter what, does what has to be done. You know, I look at that and I think about, you know, now I think of Jimmy Stewart. You know, oh, he's an actor. I know it's a movie. But it affects me when I watch it. At least it finally affects me in a positive way. It just took a long time to get there. But he who swears to his own hurt does not change. He who does not put out his money at usury, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things shall never be moved. It makes you solid. I've often wondered if as we get older, you know how we get become set in our ways? Well, what if we're doing the right thing and we get set in our ways? Maybe God allowed for that process so that if we were really focused and did these things, that we would harden in that way and never change in the end. You know, maybe there's something to that. 2 Samuel 24 is an example of David. This one has always been kind of interesting to me as well because I wonder if David really didn't understand or if he understood and he really didn't care. 2 Samuel 24. It says, the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. And it says, he moved David against them to say, go and number Israel and Judah. Now, this would be one of those difficult scripture sermonettes, except the answer is too easy because in 1 Chronicles 21, it says that Satan did it. So the he here is actually a reference to Satan when you look at 1 Chronicles 21. So Satan tempted David to go and number Israel. It was wrong. It says, the king said to Joab, the commander of the army who was with him, Now go throughout the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba, count the people that I may know the number of the people. Why did David want to know their number? Who's he counting? He's counting the men. And why is he counting them? Because he wants to see how big his army is. So that he can look across the border and see how safe he is. Because he wants to look to the numbers and the strength of his arm as such. And in that sense, at this moment, not to God. And Satan is the one who wanted David to lose focus. Because he knew that if David lost focus, he would cut himself off from God. God would no longer intercede and protect him in the same way. And Satan would have advantage. So Satan wants us to lose our focus. And so Joab, now Joab's not converted. He didn't have a heart after God's own heart. He's just a carnal individual related here to David. But Joab said to the king, "Now may the Lord your God add to the people a hundredfold more than are there. May the eyes of the Lord the king see it. But why does my Lord the king desire? Why are you going to do this to us?" Now Joab's not a real honorable guy. He's a man after his own heart. And he does what he wants. And he goes out and he fights battles, but he doesn't do them because he's so noble necessarily. He does it for political advantage. He's a warrior. But even he can see that this is a mistake. Now, does David not know it's a mistake, or does David just not care? Are there not times in our lives when we maybe know what the right thing is, but we're just not going to be pressured by having to do that, the right thing? Nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab, against the captains of the army. Joab and the captains of the army went out from the presence of the king, counted the people of Israel. Now you go through all the trouble that was caused later on, but verse 9, Joab gave the sum of the number of the people to the king. There were in Israel 800,000 valiant men who drew the sword, and the men of Judah were 500,000. So he was numbering to see just how strong he really was. Joab wasn't close to God, and he could see it was a mistake. David was supposed to be close to God, and he couldn't. Either he couldn't, or he just wasn't willing to go there. We go through that tug of war in our mind, and it's tough. Sometimes the advice we get is actually bad. David got good advice. Sometimes David got bad advice. If you go back just to 1 Samuel 24, just turn back exactly one book, 1 Samuel 24, you have the circumstance where now David had advantage over Saul. And then he was advised to take advantage of that. Look, you deserve it. This is what God would have you to do. You know, that scripture that says, you know, he who swears to his own hurt, and it won't take it back. In other words, he carries through and does what is right no matter what. David, in this case, came to that juncture where he had to make those choices. Do I want to do what feels good, or do I want to do what's important, what's most important? And in this case, David backed off. He made a mistake, but he backed off. Now, it happened when Saul had returned from following the Philistines that it was told him, saying, "Take note, David's in the wilderness of En-Gedi." Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel, went to seek David and his men on the rocks of the wild goats. And he came to the sheepfolds by the road where there was a cave, and Saul went in to attend to his needs. David and his men were staying in the recesses of the cave. This had to be a pretty big cave. I've often wondered, how could this be? But it's there. I've never seen the cave. Then the men of David said to him, "This is the day of which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as it seems good to you.'" David arose and secretly cut off the corner of Saul's robe. So he kind of wanted Saul to know that the gig was up. But then he felt bad when he stopped and realized that he had just basically done what he wanted and not what God had chosen. Now it happened after that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe. And he said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is anointed of the Lord." So David restrained his servants with these words and did not allow them to rise against Saul. And Saul got up from the cave and went on his way. Now the rest of the story isn't my point here. But the point is, David at different times in his life came to that juncture. Well, I do what is important, or will I do what I really want? And there's times when David failed that test, and there's times when he did what was right. Overall, the Bible says he was a man after God's own heart. But he had to get there. He had very strong qualities and character, but he still had to get there. What is it that helps us to make that choice? What is it that tells us? How many times have any one of us sat down and said, well, what do I do? What do I do now? What do I do in this circumstance? Look at Proverbs chapter 2. The answer to that question is one of God's gifts. Proverbs chapter 2. My son, if you receive my words and treasure my commands within you, so that you incline your ear to wisdom and apply your heart to understanding. It's describing seeking after wisdom, and it's going to show that this is God's gift. But the way it's received is because we pursue it, because we search for it, because we ponder it. If you cry out for discernment and lift up your voice for understanding, if you seek her as silver and search for her as for hidden treasure, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom. You know, God works with our mind. It's a spiritual miracle. And if you don't understand, or if you need to understand, if you want to accomplish in some way in His service, then what you do is you have to put your focus in that area and chew on it and pray about it and practice it. And in the course of that, God says, I'll work with your mind. I will give you an answer. The Lord gives wisdom. From His mouth come knowledge and understanding. He shores up sound wisdom for the upright. He's a shield to those who walk uprightly. He guards the paths of justice, preserves the way of the saints. Then you will understand righteousness and justice, equity, and every good path. When wisdom enters your heart and knowledge is pleasant to your soul, discretion will preserve you, understanding will keep you, and deliver you from the way of evil. How many people do you think Dave could have asked and asked for advice on whether it was right to number his army? From the account, it doesn't look like he asked anyone because Joab answered him and he wasn't even asked. He just told Joab what to do. He didn't really want counsel. Counsel is important. Friendship, family relationships are built on relationships where we interact with each other and impact each other in that way. But wisdom is a gift from God, and we need it. Sometimes we have to fight through the things that beset us, the things that fill our minds, the things that impose themselves on us, the choices we make. Sometimes we have to fight through that. You ever seen a movie where there's a bunch of stuff on the table and somebody finally just goes and clears the whole table and then sets the map or something down? I mean, a Western, maybe. It just wipes. How do you do that with your mind? When your mind is full of things, full of desires, full of purposes and goals and deadlines and obligations and emotions, how do you take your mind and wipe your mind clear so that you can do the right thing? Because it gets confused. Mr. Armstrong, in his autobiography, recorded an incident in chapter 22, if you ever want to go back there and look at the details. Mrs. Armstrong was pregnant with Ted Armstrong at that time. They were approaching when they would need to go to the hospital. Dick Armstrong was the first son, first child, and they hadn't paid the hospital for his birth. And back then, they didn't have credit cards and all this stuff where you just go in debt forever and then just clear it, right? So you had to have cash. And they owed the hospital for the first son. Until they cleared the bill for the first, they couldn't have the second baby in the hospital. And she was sick, too. She was very low in iron and depleted. And there were various things. They were out of food. They didn't have any wood for the winter. He had a coat with a big hole in it. He would describe how he'd fold it up with a hole folded to the inside and laid over his arm when he would go in to try to transact some business at that time, the clay that he was working with to sell. But anyway, it's an interesting story. And finally, he just says, you know, I've lost focus. I don't know what to do. I don't have a solution. I don't have the money. I can't go to the hospital. I don't have the food or the wood. I don't have the coat. I don't have my needs, my family's needs. I don't know what to do. And he describes that he started to fast. He started, in this case, I think it was on a Sabbath. And it wasn't just fast. He says, okay, what I'm going to do, I'm going to study my Bible for an hour. And then I'm going to meditate on what I studied. I'm going to ponder it. I'm going to try to understand it. I'm going to, you know, process it the best I can. And then he would pray about it for an hour. And then he would repeat it. Now, that's a task. There are times when someone was counseling for baptism that I said, look, I want you to fast before you get baptized one day. And sometime in that day, one time, I want you to study your Bible for an hour. I want you to pray, meditate for an hour. Then I want you to pray for an hour. Yeah. Ooh, you know, boy, that's a hoop to jump, right? That's just one time. Now, I don't demand it. I have no authority to demand it. Of course, I won't baptize them if they don't. I have a lot of... I have absolutely no authority, but I do have influence. But anyway, when Mr. Armstrong gave that example, I've known different people in the church over the years that when they came up to a box canyon, so to speak, and they just didn't know where to go or what to do or how to get their mind back where they could wipe the table clear and make a decision, they've done that. And I've had that discussion with a few people. But he started through that process, and it went through, in this case, it went all through Saturday and into about halfway through Sunday. And then all of a sudden he heard his father's car driving up, and what he had realized, he said, was he realized that he had lost focus. Now he said he was still praying and studying, but he'd lost focus. He was so concerned about the job, the clay, the sales, the desperate need of the family, that it had begun to fill his mind. His table became very cluttered with his worries and concerns. And he said he finally realized that he had lost focus and that he really wasn't trusting and looking to God the way that he should. And that's all he learned. He wasn't praying for anything during that period of time. He heard the car drive up. He said, okay, the task is accomplished. I see where I have gone wrong. You know, I've lost my focus in terms of relationship with God here in a specific way. God, you know, we're out of food. We don't have any wood. We can't go to the hospital. My wife is sick, and my coat has a hole in it. He says he just at the very tail as he's getting up, they're running to the door, and the family comes in, and what do they got? They got a load of wood in the car. Now, he loaded the wood before he prayed for that. God knew what he was doing. They had a big turkey in a pan. Later on, not that day, but his brother, cousin or brother or somebody, Russell, I think it was, offered him a coat, a brand new coat. And then there was an inheritance that came through the mail from a will from somebody that had died, and they finally found him, and it was exactly the amount of the hospital bill. So that allowed them to go pay the hospital and then rack up the bill so they couldn't have the next child, right? You know, yeah, work. Yeah, it's not a free ride here, you know. We get help. But he went through it and then Mrs. Armstrong was strengthened and was able to get up and go, and so, I mean, just at the very end. But the lesson was so good. And so I remember a minister in the church. In fact, I'll tell you who it was. It was Dean Blackwell years ago. He told the story. I talked to him about it. He told the story. I think it was his daughter had a boil on her neck. And they were afraid to do anything about it, and they didn't want to go to a doctor back then. You know, today I think we'd probably just use a little more medical help at the same time. But he was so concerned about it, and they were afraid if this thing broke and burst inside, the poison would go inside down the throat. That's very dangerous. And if it broke outside, it would release and heal, and they'd be clean. And he didn't. Finally, he just went and got himself a hotel room so he'd get away from thinking about everything. And he started doing what Mr. Armstrong's example here had been. He went through this hour of study and an hour of meditation and an hour of prayer, and he started rotating through that. And while he was doing that, the boil burst to the outside, and the daughter was fine. And you can say, oh, what a big mistake that was. But at that time, he did it, and it worked, and God brought his mind back to where he needed to be. When we cross that, or get to that juncture, and we get there many times, and we want to know what's right, what's best, I need to do that. And I need to, you know, not just do what I want to do what God wants. When Christ asked God to spare him from all the agony, he said, but your will be done. I don't want to go through this, but I don't want to do anything that's not what you want. Your will be done. And so sometimes we have to kind of almost fight our way in to get to the point to where our mind can make that kind of a right, proper choice, where we can clear the table enough to be able to make that decision. We had a dog. We've always had dogs. We had a dog in Pasadena. Put him out in the backyard. Dog was fine. Go off for the day. He'd come home, and everything was fine. And our lives got rather busy down there for a while. And pretty soon, the dog's out in the front and breaking out and busting through the fence and crawling through the hedge. And we'd go, what is wrong? And I'd put another board on the fence, and I'd wire something else up, and the dog would be out and just whatever it took. And, you know, I thought the problem was the fact that the fence wasn't holding the dog in, or the hedge wasn't tight enough, or something else. You know what the problem was? The dog was just bored crazy because we were ignoring it. And so we thought, you know, we need to just pay some attention to this dog. And the dog quit breaking away. We just couldn't see what it was. It was simple. I mean, it's a dog. But we couldn't see what it was. We thought the problem was over here, and it was totally something else. Again, sometimes we need to just find a way to focus our mind so that we can choose to do that which is best, just to do what is right. John chapter 21, another example where a decision was made here in terms of what was necessary and what was important, and frankly, it was the wrong choice. And Christ came back in and kind of put it back straight. John 21, after Christ here died, resurrected, here's the disciples. Well, I guess it's over, you know. Guess we better go do something. Can't just sit around here and do nothing. After these things, John 21, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias, and this way he showed himself. Simon Peter, he mentions here Thomas, Nathanael, and two others of the disciples were together. Simon Peter said to him, I'm going fishing. Now, of course, everybody's got to eat. He's not saying that. He's saying, I'm going back to what I was doing before. I'm going to go back and go to work. And they said to him, we're going to go with you too. They went out and immediately got in the boat, and that night they caught nothing. They were doing what they wanted to do, what they thought was best, what they were trained for. When the morning now had come, Jesus stood on the shore, yet the disciples didn't know that it was Jesus. And Jesus said to them, children, have you any food? And they answered, no. He said to them, cast your net on the right side of the boat, and you'll find some. So they cast, and now they were not able to draw it in because of the multitude of fish. Therefore that disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, it is the Lord. Now when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he had removed it and plunged into the sea. Now go on down to verse 15. You see, we don't usually tie in. We tell the story about the fish, catching the fish in the net. And then separately, on some other time, we tell the story about Christ saying, do you love me? But they're all in the same context. So Jesus now, verse 15, when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter. So here's the conversation that brings the object lesson of the example of why the fishes and the net and the whole example before. When they'd eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these? And I'm not going to focus on what the word love means. That's not my point. It's more general than that. He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said, feed my lambs. He said to him a second time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? And he said, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said, tend my sheep. He said to him a third time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? And Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, do you love me? And he says, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. And Jesus said, feed my sheep. You see, Peter said, I'm going fishing. I'm going back to work. I'm going to go do what I need to do, want to do, what I'm trained to do, what I thought I'd be doing anyway. I'm going to go back and do it. And Christ says, no, you're not. Feed the sheep. You know, Peter thought he was supposed to go fishing. Christ said, get to work. You are going to feed my sheep. You will work for me. They lost focus. That's the story. That's the point here. They lost focus. They needed to be able to somehow, after all the trauma and trial, to clear that deck a little bit so they could see more clearly what it was they needed to do. We care for each other in this congregation. We have to. We're a family, the family of God. And those that are not here among us need our care in a special way. If I can see you at church, then you will not see me as often in your home because we're still together. That's just the way it is for sake of the time that is available. If I cannot see you or talk to you here at church, then I will need to come see you because you can't get to me in the same way. But we all need to take and look at those among us who are not here. They want the companionship, the friendship. They want that association that is so valuable to all of us. I mentioned recently how easy it is to do something you want to do and how hard it is to do something that you don't. You know, when David was brave and serving before Saul, and Saul didn't really trust him, though, and felt that he was getting too popular, and so he had his servants go tell David, well, you know, Saul kind of likes you, and he's got a daughter, and boy, he'd probably show you a lot of favor. If you'd go out and kill 100 Philistines, Saul would be really impressed. So what did David do? He killed 200. He says, well, if he's impressed with 100, 2 ought to really seal the deal. And he went out and he went over and above. I didn't want to read the story because of the way he took head count. I looked at that and says, I don't even know how to use that in church. But I said, I can illustrate it. You know, what we put into something, the zeal, the energy, the drive, the desire that goes into it is going to determine to a large degree the level of success. I mean, we're doing the work. The work is the congregation. The work is the gospel being preached. It's all of that. It's in our prayers and it's in the physical labor. 2 Kings 13. Is a great example of energy expended and the fruit that would be returned as a result. 2 Kings 13 and verse number 14. Elisha had become sick with the illness with which he would die. And Joash, the king of Israel, came down to him and wept over his face and said, O my father, the chariots of Israel and their horsemen. And Elisha said to him, take a bow and some arrows. And he took himself a bow and some arrows. And he said to the king of Israel, put your hand on the bow. And he put his hand on it. And Elisha put his hands on the king's hands. And he says, open the east window. And he opened it. And Elisha said, shoot. And he shot. And he says, the arrow of the Lord's deliverance and the arrow of deliverance from Syria, for you must strike the Assyrians at Aphek until you have destroyed them. Now you and I read that and we would say, you know, the king didn't get very specific instructions here. I mean, he's using an analogy, but the king was there and he knew Elisha and they had communicated. And so the message was sent very, very clearly, you can be assured. God does not give us an assignment without giving us the understanding of what it is that we should do for Him. He doesn't give us an assignment without giving us the tools to accomplish His will. He does not put us in a position that we cannot fulfill. God doesn't do that. So then the account goes on. He said, take the arrows. And he took them. And he said to the king of Israel, strike the ground. These are the arrows of deliverance. that have just been portrayed to the king. He says, strike the ground, and he struck three times and stopped. And the man of God was angry with him and said, you should have struck five or six times. Then you would have struck Syria until you had destroyed it. But now you will strike Syria only three times. He knew that this was an object of deliverance that had been portrayed to him, but he simply didn't put the energy and the desire and the zeal into it to finish the task. He would have been able to completely destroy Syria had he chosen. Sometimes we are doing what is right. Sometimes we just need to keep doing a little more. That takes wisdom. When to quit, when to keep going. Part of the value in this life is enduring to the end, not just enduring, but to the end. You want to quit long before, when you're in pain, long before you're ready. I have some rocks in my little plastic rocks in the basement, and I hang from them. Yeah, when I do bad, Michelle hangs me from them, but you just hang from them, and you stay there until you just can't stand it. And they're all little different grips. It's just to strengthen your hands and arms and get used to working on rock. And there's just nothing to do. You're just like a monkey, you know. You just go, I get my little timer, and I've got it set where if it's a hard hold, I can't even get my feet totally off the ground when I'm on it. Can't. I just don't have the strength. So I hang there, and I support myself with just a little bit on my toes. And I'll hang 15 seconds, and then I got this rule where, okay, 15 seconds off, on, you get 15 seconds off. 30 seconds on, you get 30 seconds off. So you got the timer running, and you try to go in those blocks. Then there's bigger handholds, they get a better grip, and I'll hang on that for 30 seconds, and then I'll drop. Boy, you can't believe how fast 30 seconds goes when you're resting, you know. But I will drop off of that sometimes, literally groaning from the discomfort because I'm in pathetic shape. But I hang there, you know. But I literally, when I'm by myself, there's nobody around. I'll drop off. I go, oh, you know, and I'll sit there and I'll look and I'll try to think of something. But the fact is, you're always ready to quit before you're ready. Before you have accomplished the task, if it's tough. Because we don't want to be tough like that sometimes. We don't want to hurt. I need to hang twice as long before I can go climb anything. But life is like that. Part of life is just enduring until there's nothing left to endure. Enduring to the end. That's one of the character attributes of a Christian. That he never, never quits. It's like running. In the military, they used to run us. You didn't know how far you're going to run. And they run, and then they run until people started dropping out. And they'd wait. When they were losing a certain number of people, then they would stop the run. But you never knew what that would be. And so you'd be looking around to see if the guy next to you is going to quit. Because if enough of them would quit, then you got to finish the race. And you never stopped and dropped out. But you never knew. And so you're sitting there thinking you're dying. But you can keep going. You just don't want to. It's just the way life is. We get to the point where we have to make that choice. And sometimes that choice is to endure, and we have to be willing to do the right thing. Galatians 6. Verse number 6. Let him who has taught the word share in all good things with him who teaches. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. For he who sows to the flesh will of the flesh reap corruption. It's talking about having a physical or spiritual focus. On doing that which you desire in this flesh, which indeed, in this case, would be wrong, or just simply doing that which is right. But he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. Let us not grow weary while doing good. For in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. When I'm running, I'm getting some back pressure on the sermon I gave on either you do it or you don't. People are starting to ask me, are you doing it? Are you sure? I mean, I'm getting questions, you know, people checking on me now. I says, well, you know, if you do it or you don't, you know. And I thought, man, why did I say that? But until it snows, I run in the little Spokane nature area. There's trails in there and stuff. And there's hills, bigger hills than I can run. But I do notice this. Every time I run, because I mark on the hill where I stop, every time I run, I can go up a little further. And the more misery I go through, the stronger I get. Isn't that amazing? And so yesterday, I was out running, and because of the weather, and I was feeling kind of lazy and busy day. So in our neighborhood, there's a little paved road that winds up the side of Five Mile Prairie, and it's off of Indian Trail on down toward, a little bit toward the side on Francis. But anyway, Jerry and I worked out on it one time. Jerry's been there. And I got on it, and you know, usually I get about two-thirds way up and I have to quit. It gets steep, and all of a sudden I ran right to the top. I go, whoa, you know, I was so excited because I wasn't dying. I've been doing, without knowing it, I've been doing hills that were harder. I just didn't know it. I didn't think of it. So I thought, well, I'll probably get up three-fourths of the way, we'll see how it goes. I ran to the top, and it wasn't so bad. I haven't been able to do that since I was running Bloomsday, probably 3-4 years or more, since I've actually been up that particular hill and coasted over the top. It works. You know, it's our life. God doesn't want life to be that simple and easy. He doesn't want us just coasting through. He wants us to exercise our faith. He wants us to exercise our choices. But there are times when that is grueling, when that is painful, but it still must be done. We all get tired, and we're all busy, but our focus is so important. Our ability to keep our focus and to, when we have to kind of clear the deck and make that choice. Luke chapter 12, verse number 35. Let your waist be girded and your lamps burning. Don't let down, God says. You know, be ready to go. It's an analogy. And you yourselves be like men who wait for their master when he will return from the wedding, that when he comes and knocks, they may open to him immediately. I don't think I could function without a deadline. I don't have the character to just make myself do it if there's not a reason. It helps me to think about the fact that, you know, God's going to hold me accountable. Because I don't think I could always keep my focus just trying to do what's right because it's a good thing. I think I have to sometimes, quite frankly, recognize that God is a just God and that He will hold account. It says, blessed are those servants whom the master, when he comes, will find watching. Assuredly, I say to you that he'll gird himself and have them sit down to eat and will come and serve them. If he should come in the second watch, what happens if you're only ready for, you know, the first watch? But there's different watches, and there's different times. But he says, what if he comes in the second watch, or the third watch, and finds them so? Blessed are those servants. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour that you do not expect. You know, if you can see the beast power, if you can see the man of sin, if you can see the king of the north or the south, if you can see the place of safety, and if you can see all these things, then why does the Bible constantly warn us about you being not being able to see it, or being surprised and not being ready, not watching? Because when you're asleep, you don't know it. You don't know you're asleep. You don't think, oh yeah, I'm lazy, no good rotten bum. No. So the risk here is that there are times when we have to bring ourselves back to focus in some dramatic way, maybe, in order to make those choices. But you just don't, you won't know it. because you won't be watching. But you don't know you don't know it. That's the trouble. We have the most important thing on the face of this earth to do in response to God's call. There is nothing more important on this earth than what He has called His people to do. What you and I have the opportunity to do is to prepare for the leadership positions in the kingdom of God. There is nothing more important than that. And yet I know that in our daily grind, you know, Judy is putting magazines out, you know, we could go through right through the hall here and we could say what one's doing and what another's doing, and it's going to be daily grind much of the time. You know, I'm sitting at the coffee machine going, you know, and all these coffees going through, and I'm going, anybody could do this. This is what I went to college for, you know. This is what I studied my Bible for, so I could run this coffee machine. You know, I don't think so. But everybody has that. What we have is incredible, but what God wants us to be able to do, you know, the two trees, to choose. And He wants us to hold on and to stay and to endure. He wants us to use wisdom, but He wants us to do that which is right, to put Him first. You know, I go back, I can watch the movie now, It's a Wonderful Life, and when the movie's over, I will be able to say, you know, it is, it's a wonderful life. Not because it felt good that day, maybe it didn't feel good that day. I don't think Jimmy Stewart's life hardly, I mean, he was always in some kind of trouble, and he never caused it. Somebody else always brought it on him. But you know, the end of it was, there was an incredible impact and a remarkable change. This is a wonderful life because we have a wonderful calling. And we have meaning and purpose. And there is no more important thing that we could possibly ever want to do.